Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002. Goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. On BCFM 93.2, that is. This week, Bruce Kent, the boss of CND, is in Bristol. And he's talking about Trident missiles. Those nuclear weapons that are sitting on Trident submarines, floating around the world and even underneath the ice packs. Well, floating and sinking, I suppose submarines don't really float, do they? They're sort of under the surface. But anyway, Trident missiles are about to be renewed and lots of money are going to be spent on them. So we'll be speaking to Bruce Kent in a moment. We've also got Paul Fernie on this week. He's talking about astrology for a change. Well, the last few weeks he's been talking about astronomy, but I keep ribbing him about many of these star signs. And is there any truth to it? So he'll be talking about that. Also, Jeff Sparks has made a special trip to London over the last few weeks, finding out about romantic poets and also about them, about their origins and the romantic poetry days, particularly in London, and tracing some of their what they've been up to in London itself, but also looking particularly at one of Bristol's romantic poets, that's Thomas Chatterton. And we'll be speaking to Jeff after all that. But first, on to Bruce Kent.
My name is Bruce Kent, and I'm the Vice President of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and a few other things as well.
Can you just tell us about some of the other things you're also involved with nowadays?
Nowadays, I work with the Movement for the Abolition of War, which has got a wider remit than just CND, and I'm very active in Pax Christi, which is a Catholic peace movement open to all people of faith. What else am I into? As a sideline, I'm concerned with prison reform, but that's another matter.
Okay, Movement for the Abolition of War sounds a bit idealistic. War's been with us for however many millennia. Isn't this really a bit of an unrealistic objective?
I think it's highly realistic, especially when you look at Europe, which within 100 years has changed so dramatically that Germany, France and Britain can never fight again. America and Canada will never fight again. Norway and Sweden will never fight again. The areas, the dimensions of non-violent resolving of conflict gets bigger all the time.
Yes, but it's other parts of the world where there's a lot of conflict, particularly, in fact, many of the old British colonies, places like Sri Lanka, massive conflict and genocide going on.
I'm not saying there aren't difficulties. Of course there are great difficulties, especially the selling of weapons all around the world. But the fact is that domestically, here in Bristol, you don't solve your problems by shooting each other on the whole. And in the world, I see no reason at all why in the world in large we can get to the situation where we don't solve problems by shooting each other.
Well, I mean, we've got conflicts between North and South Korea brewing, between China and Japan brewing, almost all parts of the world now, particularly because of the global economic problems, people seem to be picking up the gun rather than talking.
Well, it isn't very intelligent, isn't it? The economic problems are not going to be resolved by going to war. We spend now, as a globe, we spend $1.7 trillion a year on war, and the result is more instability than before. So I think that what we have to rethink is our whole approach to security, and it's not a military matter. It's a matter of living together in harmony and sharing what we've been given.
But abolishing war, you're not going to get very far with the military. Or even with maybe people like the British Legion, ex-military, are you?
On the contrary, I think it's exactly the military, and military myself, who actually are converted, who don't want war. They're the ones who pay the price. And I think that exactly the military are the ones. Many of the generals are opposed to war, last resort only and all that, quite opposed to the Iraq war. Now they say it's nonsense, and it was nonsense.
Well, it's always easy to say that after the event. And you mentioned that you have some sort of military background. What's that?
Well, national service, my age, I'm now whatever I am, and I was called up in 1947, did 2 years, 1 year in Northern Ireland and another year with the Royal Tank Regiment. So thank God I never had to go anywhere and do anything nasty, but I was in the armed forces.
Can you just tell us what that was like for you as a youngster? Was it in your teenage years?
I was 18 when I went in. It was, to me, I'd been to a boarding school, and quite honestly, it wasn't all that different from a boarding school. You were stuck in a dormitory with a lot of blokes you never met before, and you had to obey strict discipline all around the place. I learnt a lot of interesting things. I was running around learning about wirelesses and gunnery and so on, so I learnt quite a good few good trades. I think I learnt to ride a motorbike in the army too. To me, it was an extension of boarding school, but other people, of course, had much worse experiences.
But it's not like that anymore, is it? For a lot of youngsters entering the army, there are all sorts of active regions of the world, like Afghanistan, up until recently Iraq. They're pretty much straight in at the deep end. And of course, you know, in between when you left the army and now, we've had a massive conflict going on in Northern Ireland.
We have, which we resolved, despite these... perhaps the cynicism that wars can't be ended. In fact, Northern Ireland, more or less, we've come to an end with it. Of course, the world has changed, but we did sign a document in 1945 that saying that we wanted to abolish the war globally. That's the United Nations Charter. And I think we've made a lot of progress in that direction. That there are problems is no question. Of course there are problems, but also the strong steps forward. We've got now, which no one believed possible, an international criminal court. We've got an international court that works. We've got something like a global police force. So we're moving, I think.
But what's the point in having an international criminal court if people like Tony Blair, who started an illegal war in Iraq, aren't there?
The glass that's half full is also half empty, or vice versa. The fact that we can't get Blair yet there is true, but nevertheless there are well-known criminals, Bosnia and elsewhere, who've appeared in the criminal court, and I think that's positive. I hope we'll reform the charter of the criminal court to include wars of aggression, and that would fish in future Blairs. It won't fish in a past Blair, that's over. You can't go back in criminality to legislate against it afterwards. But for the future, I think there is some hope.
But I mean, the International Criminal Court, it really doesn't have a lot of credibility all the time. It seems by some coincidence, the people who are being arranged there are NATO's enemies, largely. We don't have any war crimes that have been committed by NATO, for example, use of phosphorus weapons and other kinds of weapons in Iraq, which are supposed to be against international law. None of these people have appeared at the International Criminal Court and don't look likely to.
I can't disagree with you. The Criminal Court is not by any means a perfect institution, but it's there. And 100 years ago, no one would have believed it possible that you could actually have a Pinochet in this country terrified that he might be extradited to Spain. That's all part of the criminal legislation. And I think we've got to build on what we've got. Most people have not the slightest interest in international relations, international structures, or things like the criminal court. We need people with reform-minded ideas to come in and help change things.
Now, you've been involved in the anti-nuclear movement for decades. Can you tell us how you first got involved? What first piqued your interest?
I got interested, really, from a purely moral point of view. I met an old Catholic archbishop who said that if it's wicked to burn 100,000 people, it's wicked to intend to burn them under any circumstances. And I thought, well, he's right. You know, we wouldn't apply this to rape or burglary. And yet all the moralists were saying, oh, you can have them as long as you're never going to use them. Well, who could say you're not going to use them? So I came in on a moral position. But later on, I began to realize all the political dimensions and the stupid nationalism behind the whole business. That's why we've got nuclear weapons, because we think we're very important. But other countries, Iran, aren't important and they can't have them.
Well, I mean, many other countries do have. There's been a proliferation. There's also quite a lot of missing nuclear weapons around the world. I mean, the Americans have lost some, for example, dropped off of a bomber, which was having trouble in the Indian Ocean. Isn't it inevitable eventually that some of these weapons are going to be used by either a sort of safe Western country or one of these rogue states we keep hearing about?
Well, even worse, something that isn't a state at all. There's perfectly no reason why Al-Qaeda can't get hold of nuclear technology if they want to. And against a non-state, nuclear weapons have absolutely no significance. And that's the world we're moving into. But all this adds up to, let's get on with eliminating nuclear weapons. I think it was Tuesday of this week, we heard that a treaty was going to be signed about selling weapons abroad. Well, I think that's a positive sign. If we can get a treaty on selling weapons, why can't we get a treaty on the abolition of nuclear weapons? Quite possible.
Well, it surely isn't, because the countries that have got these weapons are very reluctant to give them up, particularly, say, for example, in the Middle East, where Israel's got the weapons and supposedly, anyway, Iran doesn't have them. They're hardly likely to give it up because it gives them the edge in geopolitics, doesn't it?
It doesn't give you anything except a fig leaf of security. It gives you nothing. There isn't a country with nuclear weapons, America, France, China, Russia, not a country that hasn't been involved in a conventional war with other countries and been defeated. We ourselves were attacked by the Argentinians over the Falklands. We got nuclear weapons. Why do they do it? Must be insane. Nuclear weapons don't actually produce security. They produce insecurity.
Now, I'm also joined by Rose Crossland from Bristol CND. Rose, can you just tell us a bit about your local group here and why you've invited Bruce down?
We're the local group for the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. We meet regularly in Bristol. We've invited Bruce as part of he's doing a month-long tour called the Scrap Trident Tour, and he's travelling, I think, for 30 days to cities up and down and towns up and down the country. The tour was launched yesterday with the big protest we held at AWE Aldermaston, and we're very lucky, we feel we're very lucky here in Bristol to have had Bruce here for the very first day of his tour.
Okay, where is Aldermaston and why were you there?
Aldermaston is about 20 miles from Reading in the Berkshire countryside. It's got a 9-mile perimeter. It's where they design nuclear weapons, and they go and build them about 5 miles away at a place called Bergfield, which is in the same area. And so it's a high, high security place with a number of gates all guarded by police. And we were just going there saying we wanted to see an end to Aldermaston and the manufacture of nuclear weapons. And we got, despite the freezing weather, we got quite a lot of people there.
I mean, is there any point to protests like that? Because, this has been going on for decades, this kind of protest, without really getting anywhere. The British are still armed to the teeth with these things.
Everything changes slowly. Look at smoking. People used to think smoking was the most virile thing you could do. Nowadays, if you smoke, you can do it in the garden. You go outside. Public attitudes change, and we're about changing public attitudes.
I mean, you must find other ways rather than just standing out in the cider in the cold looking a bit miserable. I mean, you know, isn't there any other way? Yes, well,
never.
No, well, you're
miserable
not miserable
in my life. I spend my time writing letters to the press, going to see bishops, talking to members of parliament, apart from outdoor protests, wearing badges, all kinds of things, appearing on this wonderful program like this one, slurp slurp. So any kind of way of expressing my views I get into, and so do all the people in CND.
I mean, do you get anywhere in lobbying? I mean, can you make any traction with the British military saying that these weapons are useless? Because,
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're the ultimate weapon. A lot of military people will say, well, you know, if we get another Hitler, one of these things could make all the difference.
Make absolutely no difference. Hitler, whatever. He was already mad. Hitler had a nuclear weapon. He would have used it, whether we had one or not. Field Marshal Carver, quote, "What the bloody hell are they for?" unquote. That's Field Marshal Carver. He's talking about nuclear weapons. The senior military know perfectly well they're unusable. They're not a military instrument. And it's only the stupid politicians who are brought up in a kind of Rudyard Kipling gung-ho spirit who think because we're British we've got to make a big bang.
That's nonsense, surely, because right at the very end of the Second World War it looked like there was going to be several more months of fighting with the Japanese. The nuclear weapon put a stop to that.
No, it didn't. On the contrary, nuclear weapons did stop the war, but that it was the only way? Not at all. The Japanese were already looking for the security of the emperor. That's all they wanted, that the emperor's position would not be hurt. And that's exactly what MacArthur gave them when the surrender took place. So nuclear weapons were not the only answer to World War II.
Are you saying that they were used unnecessarily at the end of the war? This is Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Absolutely. Absolutely unnecessarily. We were conned at the time, and now historians will show that they were not necessary at that time.
You can't just rewrite history like that, Bruce, surely.
I read a book called Racing the Enemy by a Japanese-American professor. It's perfectly true. The reason the war ended was the Soviets had moved 1 million people over to Manchuria and Japan, and the Japanese would prefer to surrender to the Americans than to the Soviet Union. That's how the war came to an end.
Okay. Now, Rose talked a little bit earlier on about your tour after Aldermaston and Trident. Now, Trident is our big nuclear defence. It sits in submarines. The idea is those submarines kind of float around the world, unseen, hidden, and means that our enemies, whoever they might be, could be struck from anywhere in the world. Now, that surely is quite a powerful diplomatic tool, and you're being a little bit reckless in saying that we shouldn't make sure that these are looked after into the future, these weapons.
Well, you've rather glossed over our enemies. Who, the IRA? Al-Qaeda? Who are going to use it? Who are going to use these things on? And anyway, as you say, floating around the world, what are they carrying? They're carrying missiles, and where do we get them from? We borrow them from the United States. This is no more an independent nuclear weapon.
Surely we buy them, don't we? We don't
them. We get a different one each time. We take it back to Queens Bay or somewhere in the States, and we get another set of them, and the old ones get refurbished. They're a lease lend. Harold Wilson once said, our nuclear weapons are the Moss Bros deterrents. I don't know whether you've got Moss Bros here in Bristol, but if you want to hire a dinner jacket, you went to Moss Bros. Well, they're the Moss Bros deterrent.
Okay, so what does the difference does it make, though? At least they're there for us to use if we want to.
Well, we're pretty mad. What situation would we be into? And how can we possibly meet our legal obligations to negotiate abolition when we're saying we're going to have another lot for another 30 years? And what's the message to Iran? The message is, well, Britain thinks it needs nuclear weapons. Why shouldn't we have some? That's the message.
Now, some people say, and maybe you can verify this or otherwise, that our Trident nuclear deterrent is dependent on the Americans, so that if we wish to use it, we have to kind of sort of go cap in hand even now to the Americans and say, well, we would like to fire our nuclear weapons at somebody. Is that okay? And cross our fingers and hope the Americans say yes.
I think they'd have to say yes to the targeting. Once we've got the missiles and the warheads, we could fire them, but they've got to be targeted by global satellites, and that's under American control.
Oh, so we could fire them, but then we wouldn't necessarily know where they were going to land.
That's my guess, but no one will ever tell you the truth about that.
Okay, so it doesn't really sound like an independent nuclear deterrent.
It certainly isn't an independent nuclear deterrent. We are totally dependent on the United States. Even the factory at Aldermaston is American-owned now. It's three American companies working there, not British companies. So it's all an illusion that people ought to grow up and realise that we've moved on in the world and nuclear weapons are not the answer to security.
Now, I was reading recently on the newsletter for the Campaign for Accountability of American Bases, CAB, based up in Yorkshire, that even our RAF stations where the Americans are, many of them don't even have any British RAF personnel on them. Even though it says RAF on the outside, they're actually completely staffed by the USSAF. I mean, are we in a situation where we really are, as Duncan Campbell said, I think it was in the 1980s, Airstrip One? You know, we are just a kind of the unsinkable aircraft carrier for the US.
Well, we were for a long time. I think we're the 51st state of the United States. Actually, that's what we are. But the Americans shifted all their stuff out of it. We don't have any American nuclear weapons here now. A few in Norfolk at a base there, but the big submarines have all gone because the range of the submarines, 6,000-7,000 miles, they don't need to be based here, and so the Americans haven't really got them. But we are American dependent, 99.5%.
How much does that reach into our politics? Because many people said that Tony Blair and before him Margaret Thatcher and others were very pro-US and really wanted to bend over backwards to do what the Americans wanted.
Yeah, well, when I was growing up at university and so on, people from America were Heritage Foundation shifting people over to the States to get brainwashing. Young graduates who were promising were being asked, invited to America, and that process has gone on. So many of our middle management in politics and media have actually already had a brainwashing in the United States from a year in Yale or a year in Harvard or something like that.
Now, the Trident seems to get renewed. Contracts get renewed every 20, 30 years or so. You know, this is something that those of us with a memory that goes back that long will probably remember this all happening probably in the 1990s, early 90s again. Now, you've estimated at CND that the total cost to the British taxpayer is going to be around about £100 billion. That's £100 billion
that's
for
right.
This latest renewal, which should last us, we hope, for 30 years. So that's £25 billion just for the missiles themselves and the submarines, and another £75 billion to keep them ticking over for the next 30 years. What might that money be spent on? I mean, that's a tremendous amount, £100 billion, if it's not on these.
They're talking about closing our local accident and emergency in North London to save about 3 million. But we're talking here of 100 billion. There's no single cut that's going on in this country that couldn't be met by the enormous Trident bill if we wanted to re-divert it. No, nothing that couldn't be saved if we reapply Trident. And yet there are other things that we haven't planned, like a decent old age pension or a proper housing programme, and all those things that we really do need in this country could be certainly advanced considerably with Trident money.
Now, another side to this, of course, is the connection with nuclear power. I mean, we just down the road here, we have got apparently two nuclear power stations about to be built by the French company EDF, because traditionally the nuclear material from the power stations was sent up to Sellafield and then it was used for weapons. I mean, surely we must have enough plutonium by now to blow the world to sky high 100 times over.
I think there are stockpiles of plutonium. I think the argument that we need power stations to produce weapons is getting quite thin. To me, the obstacle to nuclear power is that we don't know what on earth to do with the waste, which is lethal for tens of thousands of years. So we, in our supreme pride, are going to leave behind rubbish for our children's children's children, which can kill them long after we've gone. And that, I think, is absolutely, well, sinful, I think, is my word.
Now, one of the things, Bruce, I must ask you is that, you know, CND has been going for many years, probably started in the 1950s, did it? Or maybe even the late 40s?
58.
Is it really difficult to keep up the momentum? Because we're now another 50 years on from that, 50 years plus, to get people still excited about this as an issue that needs change when you've had 50 years and we've still got this massive Trident nuclear deterrent, it must be very difficult.
Yes, sometimes you think, oh my God, is it ever going to succeed? And then I read a bit of history. I look back at the slave trade. That took 40 years or something to change the attitude of the slave trade, or votes for women, took about 250 years to do that. So progress over different campaigns at different speeds. But I think the important thing is to do what you think is right, not whether you think it's going to work next year. And that's what I'm about.
Now, I can remember watching a programme, this is on the television in the 1980s, this week, called MI5's Official Secrets, with a certain woman called Kathy Massiter.
Now, oh, yes.
She was...
She
was... I think she was working for the Home Office, I believe. I'm not
absolutely
sure.
Cheltenham.
Oh, at GCHQ.
Yes.
OK, can you just tell us a bit about that story? Because it showed that the Conservative Party were actually using the Secret Services to spy on you. What were they up to?
Well, it was amazing. I was so innocent, I didn't realise what was going on. She came out and she said that they had succeeded in putting a spy in our office. And there was an old boy called Harry Newton, one of their agents, was in our office every week stuffing envelopes and trying to pick up what he could. And she said, they've got 6 box files on you, Bruce Kent, of information. And one of the dreadful allegations was that I was a pseudo-Marxist. Now, I don't even know what a real Marxist is, but to be a pseudo-Marxist, but that's what Harry Newton came up with. He died not long afterwards and went to his reward or whatever that was. But the idea that we were being looked at, but more sinisterly, I think many people wearing CND badges or CND membership weren't getting jobs in the teaching profession, in the media. They were being weeded out. We know that now because of their affiliation.
Have you got any evidence for that?
Yes, I have evidence for that. The chief constable up in Cumbria or somewhere had a party and he took people in to show them. They'd all had a bit of a drink. He said, I can show you the secretary for every CND group in the Northwest. He did them. I remember very well teachers writing to me at the time and saying they'd been asked what their affiliations were. No one would actually say, you're a CND member, so you can't have the job. You just don't get the job.
But that seems quite incredible that even, say, a primary school teacher in a little country school might not get a job because of their CND membership.
Well, I think you're too young. For the paranoia of those days, everywhere there were Soviet spies under every table. People were always, we were Marxists, we were funded by the Kremlin, we were this, that and the other. It was a very paranoid time.
So they were basically throwing this allegation at you that you were working for the Russians.
Oh, yeah. Oh, always.
And was there any kind of anything, you know, was there any kind of meat to that allegation?
None whatsoever. I was absolutely terrified once. I wrote an article for Pravda, the Soviet paper, and they paid me in rubles. And I had this cheque. I was terrified. This cheque went through my bank. I'd be denounced. I gave it to Oxfam and said, please send me a receipt for this cheque in rubles to make sure I've unloaded it. Oh, it was a very tense time like that.
But none of that anymore, no?
I don't think we bother them. I think we will bother them over Trident. That'll come up, and I hope the Labour Party will wake up to the fact that getting rid of Trident is actually going to be a vote winner. It's not a vote loser.
Well, don't hold your breath over that, because the Labour Party do seem to be sort of drifting to the centre ground. They see anything that's sort of traditionally left-wing as a vote loser, don't they?
Well, they're making a mistake. In Scotland, even those people who don't want independence, 75% don't want Trident. So people can add up their sums, and £100 million is an awful lot of money when it comes to good causes that it could be used for.
Now, do you actually have any former military people in CND? I mean, you know, you said yourself you were in the National Service. I think this is potentially one of the most interesting areas of people who have military expertise and have come to a professional decision that these weapons are useless.
Well, we have, and he's still alive, Air Marshal Alistair Mackey, who was a Vulcan bomber pilot, and he was one of a strong group of ex-services CND, but unfortunately most of those have died out. But now there's a group called Veterans for Peace that have come out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and they are not just anti-nuclear, they're talking about war generally, and they are turned off by the military activities of this country. So they're working for peace. But that's a different generation.
Bruce Kent, thanks very much. And we'll just finish by asking Rose. Rose, tell us a little bit about the local group, where you meet and how people can get in touch.
To find out when our next meeting and where our next meeting is, go to our website, which is www.bristolcnd.org.uk. We meet monthly at the Sportsman Pub near the centre at the moment. And another activity that we put quite a lot of our effort into is we run a short film competition for young people. It's open to anybody all over the country. A lot of our entrants do come from Bristol, though. And the film competition is judged by David Sproxton, one of the two co-founders of Aardman. And the films only have to be 1 or 2 minutes in length. We give £1,000 worth of prizes for this competition. And the films are all about on the subject of what nuclear disarmament means to you. This year, the brief more specifically is to tell us what you would like the world to know about nuclear weapons. Anything, any ideas that young people have that they'd like to express. We're not looking for technical proficiency. We're looking for good ideas, imaginative ideas. Go to the website for the competition. It's called the Chance of a Lifetime Competition, and that's at www.thechanceofalifetime.org.uk, and enter the competition.
Now, all that is very internet dependent. For people listening, maybe don't have any internet connections, how can they find out more?
Right, to CND, Holloway Road, London, mark the letter Bristol CND, and it will come straight to Bristol CND.
And the phone number to contact Bristol CND is 075 27 295 109. Say that again, 075 27 295 109, or send an email to bristolcndchair@gmail.com. That's bristolcndchair@gmail.com.
Okay, well, Bruce Kent and Rose Crossland, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you too.
Thank you.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
What a lovely couple of people they were. And joined now by Paul Fernie, another lovely man. This time, Paul, I've managed to twist your arm, haven't I? Because you really prefer to be talking about astronomy. And I've managed to get you this week to talk a little bit about astrology.
You have,
which is the zodiac.
It is, yes.
What is the zodiac? Where does it come from?
Basically, the zodiac is an ancient system of 12 30-degree divisions of the celestial longitude centred upon the ecliptic, which was used...
Just a minute. Say that again. 30-degree...
12 30-degree divisions.
Right, so hang on. That 12 times 30 degrees is 360 degrees, so that takes us all the way around.
That's correct, yeah. Of the celestial sphere.
So the celestial sphere is a sort of inside-out sphere, is it?
It is, yes. It's what the stars are mapped onto, effectively.
Okay, so it's like a kind of, you know, if you can imagine going back to sort of caveman days, you know, they could imagine that these stars out there were painted on a kind of the inside of a football.
Yeah.
And we were living in the middle of the football.
Yeah, that's basically it,
okay,
yes.
So that's the celestial sphere.
Yeah.
It's the inside of a football.
Effectively, yes.
Okay.
So you get the ancients divided it into these 12, 30 degree divisions. They are Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius and Pisces, which, as you know, are the 12 signs of the zodiac or birth signs in the Western culture.
Is there a difference in the East then?
Is there a difference in the East? There is a slight difference, yeah. In Hindu, they use the same 12 signs. However, obviously Chinese astrology is done on years and...
Okay, so it's not quite the same divisions.
It's not quite the same divisions. Okay. In the West, we use what's called the tropical divisions, whereas Hindu use sidereal divisions. Sidereal is... marginally different. Sidereal time is the time it actually takes the Earth to spin within that celestial sphere, which is actually slightly faster than the 24
hours. Isn't that every day?
That is every day, yes. And it only takes 23 hours and 52 minutes for the Earth to actually spin within that sphere. Obviously, we get 24 hours in a day to make it nice and easy to divide up our years. But the actual sidereal time, which means everything progresses very slowly within that sphere, so the points of reference move very slowly.
So do they have a different star sign every day?
No, we don't have a different star sign, because the sun's in each zodiacal sign for a defined period. Okay. Now, there are some issues around this. Back in 1930, the International Astronomical Union... basically changed the demarcation of the constellations, and the path of the ecliptic now officially passes through 13 constellations, not the 12 traditional constellations.
Oh, so there's an extra sort of hidden constellation. Can you be born under a hidden constellation?
Wow, this is something that caused a little bit of uproar back in 1995 when the BBC announced that a new zodiacal sign had been discovered, even though it had been somewhat 65 years after the IAU actually did state that the sun would now pass through 13 constellations. It appeared that they were just trying to promote a TV programme at the time.
So does it make any difference, this other constellation? What is it, first of all?
It's Orficus, which is in the Northern Hemisphere, is a summer constellation. You can view it in the summer.
Okay, and is it in between two other constellations?
Yeah, it's in between Scorpio and Sagittarius. Now, something else I just wanted to cover as well was that under the historic, the 30 degree divisions obviously divides nicely up into a year, and the sun is in each division for... sort of 30 days or thereabouts. If you actually look at the IAU's constellation boundaries, we've got Virgo, which the sun's actually in for 45 days from the 16th of September to the 30th of October, and the shortest is Scorpio, which the sun is only actually in for 7 days from the 23rd to 29th.
Okay, but I mean, you know, if you look in the paper... it's not, is it?
Oh, so you're going to pull me into this, aren't you? You're going to pull me into this, aren't you?
So what we're saying is that a lot of what we're seeing to do with these astrological signs in the newspapers and with all the stuff that goes with it, you know, predicting your future and this kind of thing, is actually very it's kind of a lot of rounding up and rounding down goes on, and it's not actually, if you start getting really seriously into astrology, you'd be in almost a completely different world.
Yeah, I mean, you can still map the sky with these traditional 12, 30 degree divisions. The map's still there, and was used, in fact, to do most of the calculations for planetary movements, etc., right up until about 1738. If you want to go down the scientific route, the astronomical route, then yeah, there are some serious sort of questions around periods of time that the sun and the planets actually travel through each sign.
Okay, so even though you think you may be one sign, actually, if you start drilling down into this, you'll probably find you may well be a different one.
Absolutely, yeah. You could find, you know, if you wanted to do it scientifically, then you may find that you are a completely different sign.
We don't want to disappoint people out there who've spent most of their lives thinking, gosh, you know, it's an incredible, I'm a typical Cancer, and then find out that they're actually some other sign completely. Modern astronomy, how do they view all this? Because are they just kind of giving specific figures for what's up in the sky for the astrological community to do things with? Or is there any kind of, you know, amongst serious astronomers, any kind of truck given to this idea that somebody who's born under a specific sign might have a different kind of personality or characteristics?
I think you'll find that any serious astronomer would sort of wash the hands of anything to do with astrology. I mean, you know, it is important to note that to distinguish the zodiacal signs from the constellations. You know, as I say, the zodiacal signs were originally a map of the sky that were developed by the ancients. And as I've already said, the IAU changed the boundary demarcations back in 1930.
So what is the difference between a constellation and the signs then? Because, I mean, we know most of us, you look up, you see the Saucepan, you know, the Great Bear. That's one.
Yeah.
You might see Cassiopeia, which is a constellation. How does this match in with all these different signs? Because there's quite a lot of constellations which don't appear as an astrological sign.
Yeah, there is. I mean, the astrological signs are basically the ones the sun travels through on its journey, as defined by the original sort of ancients mapping of the sky, this division 12 equal 30 degree divisions which the sun travels through. As I said, scientifically speaking, that's not accurate. You know, and you also have to take into account something called precession, which is the 26,000 year sort of wobble of the Earth that's caused by the gravity of the sun, the moon, the planets around Earth. And basically what it means is that the Earth sort of wobbles on its axis, which means that the constellations move, as do the equinoxes and such like, over this 26,000 year period. I mean, at the moment, for example, Polaris is known as the North Star. It's relatively close to the point. If you imagined a line coming up through the centre of the Earth, Polaris almost sits where that line would intersect with that sphere.
This is the one that you trace it up, don't you, through the Great Bear, the Saucepan, the far end of the Saucepan, I suppose you'd say, those two stars, you trace it up and you find Polaris there.
Slight arc.
This is, I think, I mean, I remember being taught this years ago at school, you know, you, this is how you find true north. If you're ever completely, you know, at a loss and all you can see is the stars, wherever you might be at, on the moors or, you know, or maybe at sea, and you're trying to locate where calendar north is or compass north, there, that's quite a good way to see it.
It is a good way to see it, and still is currently a good way of seeing it.
So long as it's not cloudy.
So long as it's not cloudy. But in years to come, it will move, and Polaris will no longer be the best star to use as your guide to the north.
I bet you we won't be alive then, will
we? I doubt we'll be alive, and I mean, you know, it depends what your stars are saying for the day.
Okay, now, finally, do you give any truck at all to this, Paul? Do you ever look at your stars?
I always look at my stars, Tony, because I love that vagueness. You know, I mean, you can read anything you want into your stars.
Do you ever find that anything actually turns up correct, or is it just all pure coincidence?
Usually, if I read the stars from the previous day's paper or the week before's paper, then I can usually pin something down in there.
Okay, so if you're looking back, you can pin something. The thing is, they're so vague and open.
Exactly.
You know. Okay, and I mean, I certainly, you know, in journalism, many times I've heard people talking about just making them up, or even just recycling them, finding newspapers from sort of 30, 40 years ago and putting exactly the same thing in, because it's a lot easier than just making it up, even.
I'm sure that is a practice that may go on somewhere.
All right, Paul, thanks very much for veering away from astronomy and talking about astrology with us today.
Thanks very much, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
US filmmaker Alan Frankovich made the definitive documentary for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing. His film The Maltese Double Cross was never repeated, but can be watched online. It presents compelling evidence of a secret motive for the US CIA to blow up Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie on the 21st of December 1988. He also directed a three-part Operation Gladio film for the BBC Time Watch series, which was shown to stunned audiences in 1992. That programme documented NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof and even the IRA. Frankovich died of a suspicious heart attack in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1997. Alongside the feature films of the Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 1970s and 1980s documentaries give us a deep insight into the criminal side of Western intelligence agencies such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad, and NATO intelligence in Brussels. All these secret political operations were deniable, but carried out under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents, and royalty. Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he released In Company Business, his film all about the CIA. And Frankovich described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo.
The CIA's been on company business for years, so what's been its job in France, Italy, Guatemala, Iran, Cuba, and the Congo? And what does Colby know, and Agee, Jackson, Braden, Nixon, Marchetti, Helms, Bundy, Stockwell, Church? And what about Truman, Ike, Kennedy? The CIA's been on company business in stealth. Now, we find out.
You mentioned some people, analysts and all, who apparently try to develop some information relative to the truth in the CIA. Has there been any dissonance in the CIA itself? Has there been any struggles from below and disgust with what the CIA is doing, other than the people who get out and write books?
Yes, well, you see, what's interesting is that if you take the American, the Washington Press, there are all kinds of recent stories appear, and often stories are leaked by somebody in the CIA or another intelligence agency who wants to get even with their boss, they want to eliminate their boss. You have to realize that these things are bureaucracy just like an insurance company, and people have all kinds of reasons for telling. And, for instance, Jesse Leaf, who entered the CIA, he told me his story. He entered the CIA. He had come in with a younger generation of people who had actually been at American universities and the best American universities during the anti-war days. And so when he entered, his generation of CIA people had a different attitude. Like, they insisted on child care for their children. In 1970, actually, there was a furor in the CIA when the United States and Nixon sent the troops into Cambodia. And they had sit-down strikes. They had petitions. And
in the CIA itself, CIA employees.
I'd never heard that.
Jesse Leaf told me. Yeah. And they're in the kind of situation where, you see, it's very difficult work, in the sense that the kind of people that the CIA looks for are motivated, they're intelligent, they're aggressive, and you have to believe in what you're doing. And many of the people who later became the CIA's biggest critics, like Philip Agee, he joined the CIA, had gone to Catholic school all his life, believed when he joined the CIA he was defending God, democracy, family, anything you can think of. Someone like John Stockwell, same thing. And when you start realizing that you're defending none of those things, as a matter of fact, you're destroying those things. And I'm not even talking in terms of the immorality of the operations, but the CIA is creating the conditions for everyone in the rest of the world to hate this country. Because they're not paying attention to what our American presidents are saying. We're the ones who have to listen to Ronald Reagan. Thank God. They're paying attention to what this country is doing to help them. The people in El Salvador are not paying attention to what Ronald Reagan is saying. He's trying to bring democracy. They know who's bombing them, and they know where the bombs are coming from, and they know where the shells are coming from, and they know who's training the troops, and they're seeing what those troops are doing. And there's no way you're ever going to convince, you might convince a student that this is right or this is wrong on the basis of abstractions. But when you're a peasant and you've just seen your neighbor's family taken out and all shot down with American bullets, there's no possible way that they're going to buy a Ronald Reagan speech next time around.
Alan Frankovich there speaking about his film On Company Business, about the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, the CIA. From the Austin, Texas VHS, back in the old days, the VHS Video News Magazine. So you used to pay a subscription to them in Austin, and every month they'd post you a VHS video with one of their interviews on. And the organisation was called Alternative Views, way back in 1982. But how relevant much of what they're doing is today.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now I'm joined by Jeff Sparks, who's been on a trip to London, a special trip actually. Jeff, haven't you, looking at romantic poets?
That's right. Yes, I was looking into the link between Thomas Chatterton, Bristol's boy poet, and the romantic movement.
Now, tell us just a little bit about Chatterton to begin with. Many people in Bristol haven't actually heard of him and don't realise he is actually from Bristol. So is there any part of Bristol where he was born or where some of his existence is known about?
Well, there is a statue of him in Millennium Square, and there, opposite St Mary Redcliffe Church in Phippin Street, there is a house, and that house is where he was born. And also the frontage that backs onto the pavement is the only remaining piece of the school, which was in the middle of what is now Redcliffe Way.
And they've just basically survived that piece of wall and just moved it and put it next to the house.
OK, well, sorry to interrupt you, Jeff. I'll let you go on with your thing about the Romantic poets.
Thank you. Thomas Chatterton, the boy poet, was born in Bristol on 20th of November 1752. While living in Bristol, he became a contributor to Felix Farley's Bristol Journal, where he had some religious poems published. Just before the age of 12, he wrote some poetry and passed it off as the works of an imaginary 15th century monk named Thomas Rowley. He had hoped he would make some money and help his mother out of poverty. He started to offer the fake manuscripts to several patrons in the hope of gaining money for the works, but when they were not willing to pay him enough, he turned to Horace Walpole. Now, he was willing to publish the works, but then he doubted the authenticity of the Rowley material and turned Chatterton away. I'd just like to mention that even though he has been classed a forger through history due to these works, I feel that at such a young age to be able to create something like that shows a glimmer of genius. A few months passed and Chatterton went from supplying Felix Farley's Bristol Journal to supplying material for the Town and Country magazine. Now, this magazine was London-based and featured stories and articles on scandals and other such behaviour amongst the upper classes. He was also supplying material to other London publications. Even before leaving for London in April 1770, Thomas was laying the foundations for his works in the capital. Now, when Thomas died at the age of 17 on 24th of August 1770, it was recorded that he had committed suicide by arsenic poisoning. But this has not been accepted by many groups and people, and a lot of research has gone into the death of this young genius and found that he might have been self-medicating due to contracting a sexual disease, and it was an accidental overdose. Around the time of his death, Romanticism was growing, and they saw the death of Chatterton as this boy poet would rather commit suicide than live a life of despair and poverty. His genius and death were commemorated by William Wordsworth. "I thought of Chatterton, the marvellous boy, the sleepless soul that perished in his pride," which is from Resolution and Independence. Samuel Taylor Coleridge wrote Monody on the death of Chatterton, and John Keats wrote To Chatterton. While researching for this feature, I decided to travel to London and spend a few days not only visiting the site where Thomas Chatterton passed away, but also visit the sites where some of the Romanticism poets were born, where they lived and where they died. I started with William Blake, who was 12 years of age when Chatterton passed away. Blake was born in 28 Broad Street, Soho, which is now known as Broadwick Street, but the memorial is in Marshall Street, just around the corner. I then moved on to where Blake once lived, which is only a half a mile from where he was born. The building is in South Moulton Street, just a short distance from Bond Street Tube Station. I then went to the site where William Blake had passed away. He lived at 3 Fountain Court, a mile from where he was born. On this site now is the Savoy Hotel. William Blake is buried in Bunhill Fields Burial Ground, the same resting place for Daniel Defoe and also John Bunyan. Then I moved on to the site where Lord Byron was born in Holles Street, which is just off Oxford Street. If you want to visit this site, then just look for the John Lewis department store, because that is now on the site where the poet was born. Now, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, he was born in Ottery St Mary in Devon and lived in London from 1812 to 1813 in a house in Berners Street, just off of Oxford Street. He died in the house of the Dr James Gilman in Highgate and is buried in St Michael's Church, Highgate. The church was closed when I visited, so I was unable to view the final resting place. John Keats was born at 85 Moorgate, which when he was born was the Swan and Hoop Inn. Nowadays it's the Globe Pub, and next to that is a building that has the sign Keats at the Globe. To get to this pub is a short walk from Moorgate Tube Station. The day before I was due to come home, I had to visit the site where Thomas Chatterton passed away. At the time of his death, he was living in an attic room above a brothel in Brook Street, Holborn. If you want to visit the site of where he passed away, you come out of Chancery Lane Tube Station, making sure you can see a statue of a soldier on your right, and on your left is a Barclays Bank. Walk towards the bank on the corner and turn left up that road, and on that building a few steps along is a plaque halfway up the building stating that in a house on this site Thomas Chatterton died. Also gives the year he was born and died. I've always had an interest in the life of Thomas Chatterton, done plenty of research on his life, and I've even wrote poetry in the room above the north porch of St Mary Redcliffe Church in Bristol, which is where the boy poet wrote his poetry. I've also visited his birthplace, which is a house in Phippin Street opposite the church. To visit the site where he passed away was a special moment for me. Not only did the Romanticism poets commemorate the boy genius through their works, it seems that their lives were spent within a few miles of where he died.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Fantastic, Jeff. Fascinating. Now, you've also got us a Song of the Week and your What's On.
Yes, I have. This is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 5th of April, Gee Baby I Love You will be performing with support from The Bones at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse at Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 5th of April, the AC/DC tribute group Hell's Bells will be performing with support from Black Sir at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Rainbow. This group formed in 1975 and split in 1984. Then in 1994, they reformed until 1997. In their career, they have released 8 studio albums and several compilation albums and live albums. The lineup from the album Rising featured Ronnie James Dio, Richie Blackmore, Cozy Powell, Tony Carey and Jimmy Bain. Here is a song from that album and it's titled Run With The Wolf. Was Rainbow with Run With The Wolf from the album Rising, which was released in 1976. On 5th of April this year, it will be the 15th anniversary of Cozy Powell's death. Into Saturday, 6th of April, Metallica Reloaded will be performing with support from Growler at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on 6th of April, the Ukulele Fun House Orchestra will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk, and there's links to BCFM from there too. Thanks to our studio guests this week, Bruce Kent and Rose Crossland from Bristol CND and National CND. Also Paul Fernie and Jeff Sparks. Dialects of Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
Friends all tell me I look so sad, and they don't need to ask me why. Another reason I feel so bad inside is just because you said goodbye. The crying and the depth of the night that keeps me hanging on, just waiting for the end. Ooh, the sweet little mystery that's in your heart. I just said, sweet little mystery makes me dry. Ooh, the sweet little mystery that's in your heart. I just said, sweet little mystery. Was the street or was the radio? I never, never turned it on. Another friend goes around and tries to say hello. Another weekend's almost gone. Ooh, another letter's you don't write. Now the arms of some new friend. Another crying that I do every day that keeps me hanging on, just waiting for the end. Ooh, the sweet little mysteries in your heart. As you said, sweet little mystery makes me dry. Ooh, the sweet little mystery. Sweet little mystery makes me cry.
I'm crying.